tell her. She wouldn't speak to me. Lyle could have told her, but he was determined to stay out of it. Besides, she was busy, Adam. Flying all over the world in that private jet. I have no doubt she'd have walked away from that had she known what was really going on there. I thought you'd be sympathetic. She was lied to. Everyone abandoned her. And so now she's just been struck down again? Poor Emma. She just keeps picking the wrong guys.
Was that sarcasm?
He asked. I apologize. I'm feeling a little like a cornered animal. Oh, God, why am I apologizing to you? Emma doesn't know I was flippin' about her troubles.
I gave her your business card. I told her you paid more than minimum wage.
You can't be serious, she said, astonished. She couldn't make in a year what her fresh flower budget was.
Was being the operative word. You might hear from her. She's having a hard time getting by.
Lyle hasn't said anything, she said.
Lyle has always been Switzerland where you two were concerned, which is why Emma knew so little about you and Jock. But get ready. One way or another, you're going to run into her. Because I'm planning to see her again.
What? What's that about?
If you two can't reconcile, that's your deal. I'm not angry with Emma or with you. And I want to see her again.
You act like you have a thing for her or something, Riley said.
I told you she was my friend, too. I'm a little worried about her. It's important to me to make sure she's all right.
He stood up. Do you have a thing for her, Adam? She asked directly.
Her brother, so handsome, such a wonderful man, was rarely in a relationship, even though women sighed as he passed. She had even once said,
"It's okay if you're gay, you know."
And he had replied, "And it's okay if you are."
"You want to date her? Is that it?" Riley asked.
"We had a glass of wine together,"
he said.
"It was good to see her. We talked a little bit about Maddie, about her return home after that sideshow back east, the difficulties of finding work. She asked about Mom, about Grandma and Grandpa. Except for Lyle and the old widow she rents from, she's pretty much alone. But we had a nice hour or so together, and I was really happy to see her again. While all that mess was going on in New York with her husband, then his suicide, I thought about her a lot. I checked in with Lyle now and then to make sure she was okay. Lyle was talking to her almost daily at the end. He was her sole emotional support. I should have called her. I think Lyle would have given me her number, but I didn't ask. I decided to wait a while, see how things shook out. Then there was the suicide and feds all over her possessions. I think what she endured must have been unimaginably painful, worse than most things I can envision. You know that Emma, like you and I, was left orphaned when her dad died. Except we had Mom, and who did she have? Rosemary, that cold-hearted bitch. So yeah, it was nice to see her, talk to her, get reacquainted. I offered her a letter of recommendation. I gave her your business card. She probably won't ever call you or ask you for work, but I'm the one that gave her the card, so don't be surprised. And if you don't mind me saying so, I think you owe her.
Oh, God, don't lay that on me. I begged her forgiveness for Jock, which she did not give me, and I can't even repeat the horrible name she called me. She didn't leave here a broken woman. She...
Girl, Adam said. She was just a girl.
Then, more quietly, he added,
so were you. You were girls.
Don't do this, Adam. Don't get involved with her. I bear no grudge, but after what happened, please don't bring her around. Please don't tell me I owe her. Not now. I know things turned out badly for her, but try to remember that while I was scrubbing floors and trying to hold it together to raise a baby alone, she went from sorority princess to New York socialite and never sent a word of forgiveness to me.
Everything is past now,
he said.
She's no longer a sorority princess or socialite, and you are no longer scrubbing floors and struggling to take care of your baby.
She rubbed her temples with her fingertips and groaned. It's over, and I don't want it all coming back. Not now. Please, Adam.
You can't erase the past any more than she can. But we can all live with it decently. If she calls you, you better do the right thing, Riley.
He was really deep down a kind person. And since he was just a boy, had felt most comfortable when the whole family was together. He didn't like loose ends. He was a protector. He'd been like a father to Maddie since she was born. And there was no question. Riley would be lost without him. She will never call me, she said.
Don't be too sure. It's really time to lay this thing between you to rest.
I have no jobs but cleaning jobs. She'd have to get her hands dirty. He laughed.
You don't think she got dirty in that New York life?
He was moving toward the door.
I'm just giving you warning.
When they were kids, people were used to seeing them together. They were known as Beauty and Brains. They were both smart and pretty, but very different. Emma was a tall, slender brunette with rosy lips and eyes more commonly seen on a doe, large and dark. Riley was blonde, 4 inches shorter, with a tight little body and crystalline blue eyes. Both were incredibly popular. And while they seemed inseparable, they spent time with other friends as well. Emma was a cheerleader and participated in gymnastics. Riley was in choir, was a pom-pom girl, and the star in the school musical, Grease. Emma was the homecoming queen, and Riley the valedictorian. There was another difference between them that Riley was extremely conscious of. She was the poor one. Emma protested that her family wasn't rich and privileged, just that her father, being a CPA, was extremely good with money. Plus, his business certainly paid better than cleaning houses. When they were in grade school at St. Paschal's, Riley knew she looked shabby. By the time she was in 8th grade, thanks to a lot of babysitting and clever shopping, she was pulling herself together quite well. But Emma grew up in a 5-bedroom house on a half-acre lot, while Riley lived in a small old 3-bedroom, 1-bath house that held 5 people. She and her mother shared a room. If Riley wanted Emma to spend the night, which was quite often, Adam would take the couch and say,
"Only if Mom sleeps in my room, because you would get into my stuff."
His stuff, as Riley recalled, wasn't all that interesting. Even that hadn't driven a wedge between them. But Riley was only 10 when she said, "My family isn't always going to be poor. You wait and see." In all the years Riley and Emma were best friends, they had about 3 memorable fights. One was in 7th grade when Riley was invited to the first boy-girl party in their class, and Emma was not. In fact, Emma was most deliberately excluded by some jealous girls. It was melodramatic and tragic. And there were many tears. They were estranged for a long, painful month. In their junior year, Emma was asked to the prom by a senior and virtually abandoned Riley for the older crowd. She did her dress shopping with senior girls who were part of the new guy's clique. Riley was crushed and sat home on prom night playing Scrabble with her mother and brother. And Emma's prom night was a disaster. The guy got drunk and pressured her for sex, so she called her father for a ride home at 9 o'clock. Both girls were miserable and sad. They sulked and avoided each other for a couple of weeks. Then Emma's father was killed in a car accident, a drunk driver. Of course, Riley and her whole family went to Emma at once, embracing her, propping her up. The girls made up and swore they'd never let such differences divide them again. Emma was so sorry she put such stock in those prom friends, and Riley was devastated that she'd begrudged her best friend good times and was so sorry things went so badly. They bonded over Emma's grief,
After all, Riley had lost her own father at an early age. She knew the pain of it too well. Emma was left with that tight-ass evil grump Rosemary and her two nasty sisters whom she didn't feel were her sisters at all. Then came college. Emma got a partial scholarship. Her stepmother said she would be able to help a little. She bought new clothes and excitedly prepared for a whole new life. Riley and Emma parted tearfully, and for the first 2 weeks called each other constantly, missing each other desperately. Then Emma settled in, became busy, got a part-time job. She had awesome roommates, was pledging a sorority. She was overwhelmed by her classes, loved the many social events and the surrounding rush. Also, Emma, being a vivacious young beauty, was getting hit on by college guys, even older college guys. She confessed to Riley that she was doing a little harmless hanging out with the guys, a little innocent dating that she didn't want Jock to know about. Of course, her secret was safe with Riley. Getting acclimated to community college wasn't nearly as exciting. Riley found it to be very much like high school, except they didn't take attendance. Big whoop. It didn't take Riley long to begin to feel lonely. As Emma settled into campus life, making new friends and experimenting with her newfound freedom, she wasn't in touch as much. She wasn't picking up when Riley or Jock called. She wasn't answering texts or returning calls right away, and when she did, she didn't have much time. She was always rushing off somewhere, or it sounded like there was a party in the background. All she wanted to talk about was herself and all her cool new experiences. A week, then two, then three went by with hardly any contact, and what contact they had was brief, just long enough for Emma to relate all the fun things she was doing. By early October, she'd already made plans to spend Thanksgiving with one of her new classmates and her family in Astoria, Oregon, rather than coming home to Santa Rosa. "I saw pictures of her house, Riley," Emma said excitedly. "I think they're incredibly rich." "We never talk at all anymore," Riley complained. "It's like you're too busy to be bothered with me." "No, of course not. Well, maybe we're growing apart a little bit," Emma said, "on account of going to different colleges, but we'll always be best friends." Riley, who used to talk to her best friend every day, several times a day, was lost. Jock, not one to go long without a girl, was calling and hanging around Riley a lot. He said it made perfect sense for them to be going out.
"You can't tell me she's not," he said to Riley. "I'm not sitting home until Emma decides she has time for me."
Looking back, Riley remembered she'd felt deserted. Abandoned. Was it too much to expect her best friend to talk to her every couple of days? Twice a week? For more than 3 minutes? And maybe ask her about herself once in a while? She and Jock were commiserating a lot. Jock was always around, calling her, taking her out for pizza, inviting her to join him for their high school's homecoming game and subsequent parties with old classmates. They were pals in their shared loneliness.
"Be careful of him," Adam said to Riley. "He's been known to take advantage of girls."
"We're just friends," she said. But Riley was growing very fond of Jock. She looked forward to every call, every casual date. They stopped commiserating so much and started laughing and having fun. They met friends at pizza parlors and on the beach. One crisp fall night, they drove over to the coast and had a few beers by a beach fire, just the two of them. It was amazing how much they had to talk about. Emma's name never came up. Riley was astonished to find she was feeling far less abandoned. She was falling for him.
"I think I might be way into you, too," he said.
"Damn,
I never saw this coming. I'm starting to think it probably should have been me and you from the start."
"We have to tell her, Jock,"
We have to tell Emma exactly how this happened. We couldn't get her on the phone for 5 minutes. We started hanging out. We got closer. At first, because we were both missing her. But then, because we have something. I don't know. Chemistry?
He laughed. You think Emma cares? Go ahead. Leave her a message. She'll get back to you in a week or two.
Then it went too far. Riley never meant for it to happen. At least not until she had thought it through much more carefully. Not until they came clean with Emma. She was telling herself it wasn't the worst thing in the world to spend so much time with Jock. To kiss and fondle and whisper in the dark of night. But then things got out of control, and before she knew it, her shirt was pushed up, her jeans were around her knees, and they'd gone all the way. Before they'd been honest with Emma.
Oh, God. I wanted us to tell Emma before something like that happened.
Baby, Emma could care less.
But I think I'm falling in love with my best friend's boyfriend.
Whoa, whoa, he said. Riley, let's just slow down here.
Aren't we in love? She asked. All those things you were saying, that you couldn't get through this without me, and I'm the best thing that's happened to you, and you probably should have hit on me first.
Hey, shoot me for being nice, huh? Of course I care about you. Who said I didn't? That was totally up to you. You were totally into it. Just don't say anything, all right? You don't have to make an announcement, for God's sake. I won't tell her. I just don't know if I'd call it love. Yet.
You have to break up with her. Tell her about us. You're the one who started things with me, not the other way around. Aren't you breaking up with her? Riley asked.
I don't think I'm gonna have to, he said. I think she broke up with me about 3 months ago.
She's partying her ass off in Seattle.
And there's no grass growing under your ass now, is there?
She threw back at him.
4 weeks later, right before Emma came home for Christmas break, she told Jock she was pregnant. She'd taken the home test, and it was positive.
You're sure it's mine? He said. I used a condom.
I haven't been with anyone else, she informed him hotly.
But I don't know that for sure, do I? Since I wasn't with you every minute. And like I said, I had protection.
What am I supposed to do?
I don't know. I guess what anyone would do. You need a little money?
She was so filled with shame, disappointment, and rage, she wanted to die. But she lifted her chin and said,
Go to hell, Jock!
But really, when it happened, she thought she loved him. And she struggled with that feeling on and off for a few years after that. Adam left Riley in her office and got in his car. He thought he'd drive by his mother's house and ask if there was anything she needed him to do, see what her plans were for the evening. He might tell her about Emma, but he hadn't decided yet. Those dozen or so times he'd gotten in touch with Emma before she got married, when she was in college and then living in New York in the city, well, he never mentioned that to his family, or to Lyle. And it seemed as though Emma hadn't talked about it either. But maybe it hadn't left that much of an impression on her.
What's that about? Do you have a thing for her?
Oh, yeah. He had since she was about 15. That summer she'd gone from 14 to 15. Man, that was the pivotal summer in a young woman's life. And Emma had gone from the little sister to a woman of interest.
I see the way you're looking at Emma, his mother had said. Do not touch that girl. Do you hear me? She's like a daughter to me, like a sister to you and Riley, and you're 18. She is off limits, at least until you're both adults. This is non-negotiable.
Her evil stepmother would love to throw you in jail. But not long after she passed her 18th birthday, she was gone to Seattle. Soon after that, Riley was expecting Jock's baby. There was a significant part of Adam's heart that was very happy Jock was no longer Emma's guy, but he was smart enough to know that until Emma recovered from her broken heart, he'd better not step forward. The next 6 years were a blur. Emma didn't return to Santa Rosa except for very brief visits, and he didn't see her. He worked two jobs and went to school. His grandparents both died. He was helping his mother and Riley as much as he could. He grew very attached to Maddie, and Emma moved to New York. He always thought, one of these days. While he was thinking that, she got married. And not to just anybody, but some internationally known millionaire. All that had changed, and she was back. Chapter 5. Emma didn't qualify for unemployment, as hers had been a part-time job. She did qualify for food stamps, which weren't called food stamps anymore. Although she'd applied online, she had to invest 4 hours in the county welfare office, completed forms in hand. It was now a debit card that would come in the mail. Soon, they said, in about 30 days, if things went well, after her application was approved. She judged herself against the great throng of people gathered in the county welfare office. She'd heard her husband rant about how many undeserving and entitled people took advantage of the welfare system, got all this free money without hardly trying. She felt like one of them, and wondered if she deserved help. Probably not. She'd been married to him, after all. She also wondered where all that free money was, and where those people who worked the system were. She'd always had visions of slick con men sauntering in and, with a flick of a form, walking out with money or some other assistance. Most of the people in the office were women, more than half with small children hanging on their legs or sitting on their laps. At least half were Hispanic. But as she'd read in the guidelines, they had to be documented to qualify. None looked like the type she expected, and no one looked at ease or comfortable about being there. As for Emma, she felt a little ill, demoralized and ashamed, like further proof she'd done something wrong. But she looked better than anyone in the place. She still had some good clothes, expensive shoes, and a couple of nice handbags, unlike everyone else there. Her clothes didn't fit so well these days. It hadn't taken long for the extra pounds she'd gained from burger hell to fall off. Job searching, the stress of it, and the sheer calisthenics of tromping all over hell and gone ate up a lot of calories. Not to mention the worry that she'd never be able to support herself again. There seemed to be a lot of hair in her hairbrush these days. Was she losing her hair? She'd been grinding her teeth at night for a couple of years, and she dreamed about losing her teeth. Awake, she worried about falling apart one batch of cells at a time. She wondered what Rosemary, Anna, and Lauren thought she was doing right now. How did they not have the slightest concern that she might be struggling? None of them reached out or asked her how she was getting by. When she'd been comfortable, before Richard's investigation began, they were always front and center. Her family. They'd wrangled first-class trips to New York on Richard's dime, and just to save himself the annoyance of having them about, he'd put them up in a suite at the Plaza Atenea. It quickly became expected. Rosemary, the woman who couldn't even have been bothered to take her shopping when she was a girl, called and in her sweetest voice would say, "It's time for our annual trip to the city, dear. Will you book it for us?" And Emma had given them such generous, beautiful birthday and holiday gifts. They never even thanked her. They thought it was nothing to her. They probably thought one of her servants bought and shipped them. The only jobs she seemed to qualify for were laborer's positions. Waitressing paid far less than minimum wage because of the tips, which waitstaff were obligated to report to the IRS.
In the end, she did better for herself by not mentioning her degree. She said she was educated through high school, stealing a little bit from Riley. She said she'd cleaned houses for work, and the only reference she had was Adam Kerrigan, because she hadn't lived around here since high school. So she took a job on the housekeeping staff of a hospital in Petaluma. After 4 days of training, she began on the day shift, punching in at 7 a.m. She made a decision, an easy one. She wasn't about to tell anyone her story. She'd like to at least pay her bills for a while. She kept it simple. She'd been married to a man named Rick. No one had ever called Richard Rick. They didn't have children. He died of a brain injury. Hospital people took that to mean stroke or aneurysm, not a bullet. She never mentioned New York. She said they'd lived in Ohio. On the line that asked for her last address, she made up a completely fictitious address in Akron. She decided to come back to California, where she grew up, where she had a few friends and some sparse family. It was a little dicey when people asked in a friendly way, "Who are your friends? Who do you hang around with?" At which point, Emma began to have secret, imaginary friends. "Oh, my girlfriend Marianne, who I went to school with, and a cousin Jennifer, who's married with two kids. Then there's Ruth, my favorite aunt, who's only 4 years older. I'm close to them." The women on the housekeeping staff she worked with were exceptionally friendly, reaching out to her, warning her about the supervisor, who was a dragon lady named Glynis Carlson. Glynis was short, wore a 40-year-old hairstyle with one silver slash in front, came upon them like an unexpected storm, and without even raising her voice, threatened their very lives for having a cell phone out, for disposing of soiled linens wrong, for leaving streaks on the floor or porcelain, letting their carts get overladen, or worse, understocked. And that was nothing compared to the way she berated people who weren't keeping up with their assigned area, which was very hard because nurses and aides were constantly summoning housekeeping. They didn't help with cleaning up beds or patients, of course, but anything that hit the floor was passed on to the housekeeping staff. There were a lot of messes that hospital staff didn't handle. The horrid ones. "Be glad you're not in the ER or the operating room. Wear a mask and never work without gloves. Just change them out," advised Barbara, one of the cleaning staff who'd been around for years. "Wrap as much mess as possible in the linens. Careful not to get any plastics or papers in them. Get them down the chute fast as you can. Let it be laundry's problem. They transfer it all with big sticks and hooks." There was a lot of that in a hospital. The doctors passed it off to the nurses, who passed it off to the orderlies and aides, who passed it to housekeeping, who passed it to laundry. It was hard, ugly work, but steady, and among decent people. Emma had never been shy of hard work, and she was growing confident and a little bit happy. She had work. She had just enough money and didn't require much to live on. Life in her tiny bungalow was compact and uncomplicated. Not only were her co-workers nice to her, but the patients and their visitors were also pleasant. And under the direst of circumstances, illness. Cleaners weren't allowed to have traffic with patients. They weren't trained for that. But there was nothing preventing them from being cordial, going for an extra water jug for flowers, calling nurses when they saw a problem. "Just don't touch them," the dragon lady said. "Not even if one of them falls. Switch on the emergency light and stand by." "Not even if they fall?" Emma asked, aghast. "All you need is to help someone off the floor and break their neck or something. You'll lose your job and the hospital will get sued. You never move an accident victim. You let the professionals do that."
"Makes sense, when you put it that way," she said.
"Think of them all as accident victims," Glynis said. "Just get their bathrooms clean." But despite these terrifying warnings, Emma warmed to the patients, particularly the elderly. Little old people were so vulnerable when ill, and she found she couldn't turn away. The old women loved her, and the old men loved her more,
and she just couldn't stop herself from offering the occasional sip of water to someone who was struggling with the tray table or a glass. It pleased her to hand a wet washcloth to someone who needed it. She even stayed late and read to an 85-year-old blind woman, though she was careful to ask the Dragon Lady for permission first. "I'm not allowed to help you to the lavatory," she told the woman. "I'm so sorry, but I'll get the nurse."
"I hate the nurse. I'd rather it be you."
"Oh, I'd be happy to, but the housekeeping staff has been threatened with dire consequences if we break the rules, even just slightly. I'm not trained in patient care. Let me get that nurse, and I'll stay with you until she comes." She started thinking about possibly training as a nurse's aide. She had 3 very blissful weeks in her hospital job, though it was the hardest work she'd ever done. She didn't care. She went on breaks with coworkers, she ate lunch with her new friends, heard about their marriages, their kids, their aging parents, their car problems, and vacation plans. Emma began to have fantasies of a normal life. It wouldn't be a rich life for sure, but at this point, a rich life only represented disaster and danger to her. She was looking for stability, nothing more. She had her food debit card. She handed out Halloween candy with Penny. The leaves finished turning. November came in wet and cold. She got together for wine with Lyle and Ethan, who was almost starting to believe she wasn't a bad person. She spoke to Adam on the phone a couple of times when he called to see how she was doing. She had a light dinner with Penny on TV trays, watching Madam Secretary with her, just like normal people. Penny invited her to join her with her girlfriends, Susan, Marilyn, and Dorothy, for a potluck one evening, and to her delighted surprise, these old girls liked martinis. Susan's son was the chauffeur for Susan, Marilyn, and Dorothy.
"I told him I was completely capable," Susan said. "But it's just as well he wants to drive us. That way we can have 2.
"William is such a nice boy," Penny said of Susan's son.
"That boy is 59 years old," Susan said. "Before long, I'll be chauffeuring him."
At 2 weeks until Thanksgiving, Emma had more than one offer for the holiday feast. Lyle and Ethan were going to Ethan's sister's house and had graciously included her. She might have gone, but for the fact that Penny and a couple of her widowed girlfriends who were sharing the feast also invited her. And they were to dine at Penny's little house. She dearly wanted to join them.
"Being one of the new kids at the hospital, I'm sure I'll have to work that day," Emma said.
"We took that into consideration," Penny told her. "We'll be ready at about 4. That should give you time to get home, shower, come over for some pre-turkey poo-poos and wine."
"Let me pick up the wine," she said.
"You're absolutely welcome to."
"And I'll visit Lyle's shop and see if he'll give me a break on a centerpiece," she added.
"Try your best, darling, but be warned. He's going to gouge you. I've been looking for a discount for years. I guess I can't complain," she said with a smile. "He gave me you."
Emma was having a life. She had friendly acquaintances at work, a paycheck large enough to cover her most immediate expenses, friends apart from the hospital, 2 invitations for a holiday dinner, a comfortable place to live. It didn't even bother her that her own family hadn't so much as called to check on her, much less ask her to join them for Thanksgiving dinner. In fact, she was relieved. Just as she was beginning to relax, something weird happened. One of the older nurse's aides was glowering at Emma for no apparent reason. Clarice seemed angry about something. Angry or on edge? Some others seemed to be following suit. It appeared to be an unhappy day on the ward. There was a static in the air, and Emma knew something was wrong. There had been a couple of emergencies. Maybe that was setting everyone on edge. The static turned to an electric crackle. Emma tried not to notice, but she was beginning to feel paranoid by the behavior around her. It didn't last long. It was 2 in the afternoon, about an hour until shift change. A patient had been discharged, and the room was ready for a terminal cleaning. Emma got her cart, mop, linens, gloves, and went to the room. Standing there beside the now empty bed in a room with no other patients was Clarice.
"How much do you have stashed away?"
she asked, her voice hard.
"What?
You heard me. How much do you have stashed away?
Enough to take care of my elderly mother? Because Hugh and I can't afford her, and she has to live with us now since her entire savings was stolen."
What are you talking about? Emma asked, fearing she knew.
"I know who you are, Mrs. Compton. We all know who you are. My mother's name is Roberta Sinclair, and you took everything she had. And I think you can find a way to get it back."
Oh, no. Even though she'd been over every possible scenario, now Emma didn't know what to say. She just shook her head.
"There's nothing," she said. "I have nothing."
"You have assets in your name," Clarice insisted. Emma shook her head again.
"There's nothing in my name. Everything was in Richard's name, and the few things that weren't, I surrendered. All our possessions were auctioned. I surrendered those as well. Do you honestly think I'd be scrubbing floors in a hospital if I had anything?"
"For a while, yes," she said. "You'll lie low for a while, then when the talk has died off, you'll tap into your hidden money. I read the book."
"The books are wrong. The internet is wrong. Everything is gone. My wedding ring, my wedding gown, wedding gifts. I gave it all back. I'm not lying low. I'm using my legal name. I haven't even colored my hair. I didn't know what was going on, Clarice. I had nothing to do with Richard's business."
"What about offshore money? One of the books says he was about to give the SEC account numbers when..."
"Gone. He was trying to negotiate a smaller sentence, but there's nothing that I know of. Nothing left to me, I swear."
"The book says you retained $1.4 million and a lot of valuable property."
She was getting dizzy, shaking her head. "I kept a few thousand so I could drive back here and rent a small space. The U.S. Marshals sold everything at auction. Everything. I kept some sheets and towels, a few dishes and pots. I gave most of my clothing to women's shelters. There's nothing. Do you think I want to be tied to that hideous crime? I was told that investors got roughly 32 cents on the dollar. I couldn't do anything more."
"You're lying," Clarice said. "You had lawyers. My mother didn't have a lawyer. She couldn't afford one. And she didn't get that much. She borrowed against her house to invest with Compton."
That wasn't exactly how it worked, as Emma knew from the trial. Richard Compton worked with a number of financial managers and brokers who represented smaller investors, and it was they who invested in his company. Richard didn't talk anyone into mortgaging their house. He talked hedge fund managers into investing with him, and he neither knew nor cared where they got their money. Large sums. Many collections of smaller investors. Richard was big time. He had a minimum requirement, probably 100 times the value of Mrs. Sinclair's mortgage. "My lawyer was assigned by the court, and he wanted me to keep enough to live on, since finding work would be hard. But I didn't keep anything."
"I'm sorry," Emma said.
"I'm so sorry. I would never have let something like that happen if there was anything I could do to prevent it."
"You're lying."
Clarice picked up a bedpan that sat on the now vacant bed and hurled it at her. Emma blocked the missile with her forearms, but that did little good. The damn thing was full. Since she knew the patient just discharged was ambulatory, Clarice must have looked high and low through the whole ward for just the right bedpan. Or more likely, she emptied catheter bags into one. The splatter threw Emma off balance. She stumbled backward, hit her tailbone on the pail on her way down, and cracked her head on the metal door handle. She was covered in filth. When she tried to stand, the world was spinning, and she ended up scooting across the floor, escaping out of the room into the hallway.
"Oh, my God!" one of the other housekeepers said, running to her. "What happened? Are you hurt?"
Clarice walked out of the patient room and, lifting her chin in the air, walked past Emma. She went down the hall to the nursing station.
"Can you get up?"
the other housekeeper asked.
"I don't know,"
she whispered.
"Ugh! Oh, God! This is awful!"
"How did this happen?"
"She threw a bedpan at me. Apparently, she was swindled by... My late husband was guilty of... Oh, but I didn't know,"
she said, turning imploring eyes to her friend.
"I swear I didn't. I would never. And he's dead now."
Two of the RNs on staff came running down the hall. One said,
"Dear God."
The other one said, "Clarice has lost her mind." They tried to get Emma on her feet, but when she swayed and threatened to fall again, they went for a wheelchair and took her to the ER. She tried to briefly explain the problem, but it didn't come out well. She tried to tell them she'd been married to a bad man, a thief, but she didn't know it, and it seems Clarice was one of his victims, but Emma didn't know.
"I should have done something," she thought. "I should have done something when I wondered why lawyers negotiated our prenup, but Richard had hired both of them. I should have asked questions when this fabulously wealthy man wanted to marry me, but I didn't. I should have done something when the SEC started investigating him. I should have looked through his papers or found a way to hack his computer when I realized something was wrong. But I didn't know. I should have known. How could I not have known? I should have talked to the people who worked for him, the people who eventually testified against him. I should have found out how they were going to carry on. They got deals from the prosecutors. Everyone got deals. Even his mistress. When everything was so murky, so mysterious, I should have looked into it. Maybe I should have hired a detective or something. Maybe I should have run."
"Clean her up and get a head CT,"
the ER doctor ordered.
"Listen, you might have a concussion, Emma. Can you get a ride home today and a ride back for your car tomorrow?"
"I don't know,"
she said, thinking,
"I'm covered in urine. Who wants to drive me home?"
"Well, you can think about that. We're going to get you some clean scrubs, stand you in the shower and wash you off. Mandy will go with you and make sure you don't faint or fall in the shower. And while you're having your CT, think about who you can call. If there's no one, someone from the hospital can either take you home or put you in a cab. You can't drive for 12 hours at least. And Mrs. Carlson is waiting to see you, but let's get you cleaned up first."
Glynnis.
Glynnis was going to fire her. She was taken to a shower. Her smelly uniform was put in a plastic bag and a set of scrubs provided.
"I think your shoes are fine," Mandy said from right outside the curtain.
"My shoes are fine because it hit me in the head and got in my hair," Emma said with a hiccup of emotion.
"Just to be safe, throw the shoes in the washer when you get home, or spray clean them with some disinfectant cleaner."
"You can wash those?"
"I do it all the time. They're just running shoes. Canvas and that little bit of leather."
"If I'd been doing my own laundry and cleaning instead of hiring people to do it, I'd probably know that," she thought. Emma was given a comb and had a little lip gloss in her purse. By the time the doctor looked at her head CT, her hair was almost dry and completely mangy-looking. Without some product, a brush and a blow-dryer, she looked like a wreck. It was a relief to be clean, but she wasn't feeling much better about the whole thing. They gave her a list of symptoms to watch for, and she had a very large bump on the back of her head, but that didn't hurt nearly as much as her tailbone where she'd hit the metal bucket on the way down. She was given some ibuprofen. The doctor was insistent that she not drive herself. Emma thought about just ignoring the instructions. Then her wiser self intervened and reminded her that all she needed was to pass out while driving and kill a family of four.
She couldn't bear the thought of calling Lyle and having Ethan snigger to learn that her past was kicking up trouble. She didn't want to call Penny. She didn't want her landlady having second thoughts about her decision to rent to her. She texted Adam.
I fell and had a little accident at work and need a ride home from the hospital in Petaluma. Are you available? If not, I'll look around for someone who will give me a lift.
He responded immediately.
School's almost out, so I'll come for you ASAP. It'll take about an hour to get there. Are you all right until then?
I'm okay. Text me from the parking lot and I'll come out. And thank you.
She went to Glynis Carlson's office and sat outside her door, holding the plastic bag with her work clothes in it. It was a few minutes before the dragon lady opened her door and motioned Emma to come in. She indicated the chair in front of her desk. Then Glynis folded her hands on top of her desk.
Would you like to tell me what happened?
I'll try, Emma said. My husband was Richard Compton.
Do you know the name? Glynis nodded. She explained that Clarice claimed her mother was a victim, but Emma had only met a few of Richard's clients socially. They were typically big investors or multimillionaires. She'd seen a few in court and was surprised there was anyone from California, especially surprised to learn it was Clarice's mother. But the crime was Richard's, not hers.
You should have told me,
Glynis said.
You wouldn't have hired me.
I might have hired you and put you on the night shift. Well, spilled milk. Now you have the prerogative of calling the police and filing assault charges. The nurse's aide who attacked you will be disciplined, possibly fired, but you can still...
Emma shook her head. It would be a mistake to draw attention to it. Plus, I do understand her anger. I really do. Thing is, I can't help her with this. I surrendered everything. I didn't want anything Richard had gotten by swindling people. There isn't anything.
Why does she think there is?
There were a couple of books written about Richard's crime, lots of articles, news stories, and internet posts speculating that I had some of his money hidden away. False, of course.
Emma, you can't work with the public even though you've been exonerated for wrongdoing. Not for a long time. Do you understand that?
I'm trying to keep a low profile, she said.
I'm applying for workers' compensation for you, Emma. I've taken you off the schedule. You should take 2 weeks, and then my recommendation is that you resign and find something else. You'd do better in hotel housekeeping. Less contact with the public.
I'm not hurt that badly, she said. I don't need to...
This isn't the place for you right now, Emma. You should take the time. You're entitled to it.
But you're not going to fire me? She asked.
As far as I know, you haven't done anything wrong. But I want you to think about whether this is the right job for you. I can put you on a different shift from the aide who beamed you with the bedpan, but I'm sure she has friends. Word will travel. Life could be difficult.
She almost laughed.
I might not have any choice.
While you're recovering, check out the hotels in the area. That's an option. You'd be working alone, not with a lot of other employees. You'd rarely come into contact with guests. Or,
wait a second. She reached into her drawer and began to shuffle through business cards.
This woman has an excellent service. Domestic, business, etc. But for God's sake, tell her the truth from the start. And if you need one, I'll write you a letter of recommendation. You've done a good job here in your brief employment.
Emma looked down at the card. Riley Kerrigan.
Lord, she was everywhere. Yes, ma'am, she said.
The only advantage she could see was that she wouldn't have to explain her circumstances.
Think things over. Call me with your decision, please.
Yes, ma'am.
Emma went from Glynis Carlson's office to the restroom. She took several deep breaths. Glynis had been kind. Fair and kind. But Emma had to face facts. People would blame her.
If they didn't blame her as a co-conspirator, they'd blame her for not taking action, or for not testifying against Richard. They'd never believe she had nothing to say, nothing to add.
"Keep your head," she told herself. "It's only been 6 months. This could go on a while. You knew it wouldn't be easy, no matter where you went, no matter what you did."
Then she put the bag holding her soiled work clothes in the trash can. She went to the locker room in the basement where they clocked in and grabbed her jacket. She wasn't going to wait around for Adam where other employees might pass her on their way to their cars. There was a nice little courtyard behind the emergency room. It was primarily there for those die-hard smokers left in the world, but no one was there at the moment. The sun was shining. It was a beautiful fall afternoon. She sat with her back to the door and talked to herself a little more.
"It's only been 6 months. Some of his victims will be angry for the rest of their lives. Many will feel his death wasn't punishment enough.
And there would always be those who believed she had some of that money, that she had a plan, that she was just waiting to emerge like a phoenix, rolling in dough, living the high life.
It's only been 6 months, so don't cry."
But silent tears streamed down her cheeks. A few minutes had passed when she heard the door behind her open. She heard a little rustling, some footsteps, then a man walked past her. He was carrying a cellophane-wrapped bouquet, hanging down at his side. That was the rustling she'd heard, the cellophane. He walked all the way to the end of the courtyard, then turned back toward her. He glanced at her briefly and sat on a bench several feet away and didn't meet her eyes. He was looking at his knees. She gave her eyes a little wipe. He looked up.
"Bad day?"
he asked. She nodded.
"You?"
"A little disappointing. But it'll all work out." "What happened to you? You're a doctor?"
She shook her head. It was the scrub, she realized.
"Ah, nurse. I guess nurses can have all kinds of bad days."
She didn't respond because it wasn't required, except that she had this real problem with deception. No one would believe that, of course. She imagined almost everyone thought she was a liar. Her cell phone chimed in her pocket. She took it out and saw Adam's text.
"I have to go. My ride is here," she said.
"I hope your day gets better." He actually stood, and she realized he was very handsome. Also tall and broad-shouldered.
"I hope yours does, too. Here,"
he said, holding out the bouquet.
"Take these. They will go in the trash otherwise."
"Can't you take them home to your wife?"
"No wife."
"Your mother? Daughter? Sister?" He smiled, improving his looks even more.
"Nah. Here. Enjoy."
She just stood there.
"Come on. Someone just did something nice for you. Take them."
She did. She said thank you. She went to Adam's SUV in the parking lot and climbed in the passenger seat. He eyed the flowers.
"Parting gifts?"
he asked. And she burst into tears. Chapter 6. Adam knew something was wrong. Something more than, "I fell at work." He wasn't sure how he knew, but he knew. He stopped on the way to the hospital and picked up a couple of large mocha coffees with heavy cream. When he asked Emma what had happened, there was a lot of incoherent blubbering, and he decided it was probably best to drive rather than sit in the parking lot while she emoted. And emoted. He picked up a few things. Someone had identified her, recognized her, threw a ripe bedpan at her head. There was a lot of whimpering about how she hadn't known, hadn't been complicit. Everyone thought her a gold digger, a liar. She ended with some incoherent bawling about the disgusting state of her hair, comments that caused his eyes to widen in shock. What did this have to do with hair? He found a nice park and pulled into the lot in the shade of a colorful tree. He handed her some tissues, and after she'd made use of them, gave her the coffee. And the world slowed down, and she began to just talk about it. Adam had a feeling he was going to hell for this, but he wanted her to get this issue resolved, in her mind at least, emotionally, because he just couldn't pursue her the way he'd like to until that happened. She just wasn't ready. She wasn't moving on yet. Everything was so unsettled for her. And that had more to do with what Emma thought of herself than the people who might think badly of her. "Thank God I ran into you at the burger joint," she said tearfully. "Just take me home, please, Adam. I didn't mean to unload on you."
"Nah, we're not going home yet. You're going to have some coffee, calm down, and we'll just talk a while."
"I'm sure you don't need all this chaos clogging up your mind."
"My mind is fine," he said.
"I'm a little worried about yours. It seems like maybe you're still feeling confused, out of control, vulnerable, victimized."
"Wouldn't you?" she returned defensively.
"Probably. But I want you to think about something, Emmy. Lack of power comes from lack of knowledge. Unless I'm totally off base here, you're still completely confused about what happened to you, how it happened, what to do about it now."
"I don't know what you're getting at," she said.
"Have you seen a counselor?" he asked.
"What kind of counselor?" she asked.
"Okay, I'm just guessing here, but I think you're still in shock. Maybe you have a little PTSD because you're not advancing beyond the shock."
He actually smiled slightly when he noticed she was looking at him with wide, startled eyes.
"PTSD isn't limited to war veterans, Emmy. Anyone who's been through a trauma qualifies. With a war veteran, it might be a car backfiring that sends them into a series of PTSD symptoms. Anger, sleeplessness, fear, panic, phobia, so on. For the victim of emotional abuse, it might be facial expressions, certain comments, another's rage or threat. You should check this out. See a counselor."
"Listen," she said earnestly, scooting forward in her seat and turning in his direction. "I don't have the money for a counselor, and I have health insurance for emergencies. But no one, I mean no one, is ever going to offer me discounted therapy because I suffered through kissing goodbye to millions of dollars after living like a queen for years."
"Victim,"
he said.
"You are a victim. And you were probably a victim then, not a queen. You need some help. I'll check around. I might find someone, you never know. I know everyone. I've been teaching half their kids for 15 years. But while I look, you might want to do some reading. From what you say, you still have so much mystery about what happened to you. You can't even figure out how you ended up in this mental, emotional minefield. And there must be some kind of explanation. If there's not a clear explanation, there might be enough information out there to help you draw some conclusions. Hit the library. Read those books written by other people who think they've drawn conclusions. Find out who they think you are, and who they think your husband was."
She was shaking her head. "You have no idea what you're suggesting, how painful that is. Just the little excerpts are horrible."
"I know."
"You know? How do you know?"
"I read about it all,"
he said with a shrug.
"Lots of theories about your late husband, about you. Varying theories."
"Why?" she asked softly. "Why would you read that trash?"
"Emmy, I'm a science teacher. We investigate. We look shit up."
Then he gave her a wan smile.
"I'm just suggesting, since you can't escape it, maybe it makes sense to face it."
"I thought I'd been facing it for the last several years," she said. "I was in the apartment when Richard blew his brains out after all. I had to hide from angry plaintiffs. I had to watch the house stripped of personal possessions.
You wanted it behind you, and who could blame you? Now that the whole fiasco is part of your identity and you have to live with it, would it help to understand it better?" Like, what kind of man was he, really? Because you don't actually know, do you? You've said that had you known, you would have run for your life. So what do you know about sociopaths? Because that's my guess. He was a sociopath.
What do you know about sociopaths? She asked.
He shook his head. Just a little bit, but I admit to being fascinated. I think when they were passing out consciences, they missed a few people, but they gave the surplus to me. My conscience seems to work overtime.
He reached for her hand.
If you understood, at least as much as possible, could you be at peace?
I don't know.
Find out,
he suggested.
I'll help if I can. I love research, and I love talking to you. But first things first, you need a few days of rest and ice on your head.
And my butt, she added.
Did they x-ray that part?
No. They said if it remains painful to come back in, but it's already better from just a couple of Advil.
Then let's keep moving forward. It's time to call Riley and see if you can get a job. It doesn't have to be a long-term job, but you have to have something.
Oh, Adam.
She'll protect you, Emmy. She knows how hard it is to start over, to rebuild your life after you've hit bottom.
I can't believe she'd actually help me, she said.
Sure she would. In fact, if she doesn't, that would mean I don't know my sister at all. And that's not possible.
Does she know we've been in touch lately? Emma asked.
She knows I ran into you at the burger joint. She knows we had a glass of wine and I gave you her business card. That's all she knows. In fact, I never mentioned we'd talked after you and Jock broke up. After Maddie was born.
It was more than a few times, Emma said. And why didn't you tell her?
He took a moment.